Hi, everybody. Today is Friday, April 4th, 2025, and our friend Larry Johnson is back with us. Welcome back, Larry.
Yeah, you know, you coerced me, so I had to come. Threatened to take me hostage. You Iranian terrorist. Okay, no, you're a good guy. I'm sorry.
Larry, let's get started with the situation that between the United States and Yemenis and Sarawak in Yemen.
Yeah.
Here is what New York Times reported, citing Pentagon officials, that we haven't had much success in destroying the Houthis' massive arsenal.
Really? God, that's a news flash. I'm shocked. Sorry. Yeah. We could have. We said that's what was going to happen at the outset. These dummies. Good Lord. Okay, sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, and here is what Marco Rubio said, Larry.
On the Houthis, everybody wants to get their ships through the Red Sea. We're the only ones doing anything about it, but everyone wants to, you know, get their ships through there. As I said, we've done the world a great favor by taking on this band of criminals who have, unfortunately, sophisticated weaponry that they can use to... I mean, they attack with 150, 160 merchant vessels. 174 times they've attacked the United States Navy. So I think the world should be grateful to the United States for being involved in this and doing this. Everyone thanks us for it. I understand these nations have limited capabilities despite being very rich countries. Nobody else can project power there and do this. But that said, we think that mission is going to bear fruit, and it's necessary. We can't have a band of criminals controlling that.
Larry, how do you find the learning curve of the current administration in terms of fighting with Houthis, with Ansarullah?
Going down. They're not learning. Look, the key to this, you know, he tries to pretend that the Houthis are just hitting every ship that comes in, regardless of who it is, what it is, where it's going. And that's just not true. You know, if you're Russian and Chinese and you're not going to Israel, have a nice trip, you know, no problem. They're going after the ships that are either owned by Israelis or serving Israel, taking Israel, either carrying goods to Israel, trying to export something from Israel. This is about the genocide the monsters in Tel Aviv are committing. And the Houthis, to their credit, are standing up for it. Biden administration was, you know, under Lloyd Austin announced that Operation Prosperity Guardian. Too much fanfare. And, oh, yeah, we're going to go in there and we're going to kick some Yemeni booty. Okay, didn't work out. Why? Well, primarily because the missile arsenal that the Houthis have is both buried underground and mobile. So they're not operating from a fixed site. You know, if they had a fixed location, sure, it'd be a piece of cake to go in and, you know, take it out. But that's not what they're doing. And so instead of recognizing that, we could assume that, everybody... all we had to do is flex a little muscle and the Yemenis would go running in fear. And this bull in the China shop strategy, you know, the U.S. could get away with it 50 years ago. And even then it didn't really work. But now, forget about it.
In the same article that I've mentioned, New York Times reported, Pentagon estimates... operation against Houthis will cost $1 billion per month. And is that...
I'm sorry to laugh.
You put the tariff, Larry, you put the way that Donald Trump is dealing with tariffs, and we've learned about on the Liberation Day, and he was mentioning that. And the way that he's spending... in Yemen, against Yemen, how you can put these two pictures together? Is he really concerned about that? Is he, how long do they want to stay there and fight in Yemenis?
Well, look at it from the standpoint of the companies that make the weapons systems on those ships, you know, particularly the vertical launch system missiles. Every time those destroyers fire at an inbound Houthi missile, that means the U.S. government's got to go buy more. And those corporations, boy, you know, they're probably sending secret messages to the Houthis to keep firing or to fire more. You know, the more they use up, the more the U.S. is going to have to buy, and the better those companies will be off in terms of financial income. So it is sort of dark and twisted, but yeah, I guess they got their 17th drone the other day. So those, the MQ-9 Reaper, and that the minimum cost on that is like $30 million. So, you know, we're talking $510 million, $500 million have been shot down the last 15 months. That's a lot of money. And so, you know, I think the $1 billion a month estimate, that's probably spot on. And that's costly. And, you know, candidly, I don't think the U.S. can afford it. But, you know, they don't sit down and count the cost. They just do it and then figure out, we'll write checks later.
But do you think that they're going to, finally, they're going to say that we're going to talk with Yemenis. Let's talk with them. Do you see that coming, or they're going to just continue the same way?
Why talk to the Yemenis? They're crazed Muslims. Don't you understand? You know, I mean, really, we don't even view them as real people. Okay, it is it's really another form of racism that we view them, you know, the derogatory term. Let's call them sand monkeys. Yeah, you know, they're primitive, they're poor. But yet, for being primitive and poor, they have fought the U.S. government to a standstill for the last 16 months, 17 months. Pretty remarkable. other countries around the world that have stood in fear of the United States got to be looking at that going, huh. I mean, particularly like the Chinese. If a carrier strike group is struggling like the U.S. is right now to stop the flow of missiles, imagine what would happen if you put a carrier strike group off the coast of China. China's got some things that the Yemenis don't have. Number one, they've got ISR, they've got satellites. So they'll be able to locate the U.S. ships much quicker. And they have a larger array of hypersonic missiles. And they've got aircraft that can launch bombs and the U.S. ought to take a lesson from this, that when this one little country can fire 174 attacks on U.S. ships over the last 17 months, you know, that's 10 a month. Pay attention. There are limits to our military power.
But by the way, it seems that they're so simple-minded in terms of how to deal with Houthis, because the way they're talking about Iran, it seems that Iran is capable of putting a lot of pressure on Houthis and just forcing them to change their behavior. Do you think, Larry, do you think that Iran is interested or is capable of changing the mindset of Ansarullah in Yemen?
We need to look at that. That's a relationship of friends. You know, friends, usually you're friends with people that share common interests. And while the Yemenis practice a different version of Shia theology, It's a, I understand, I've been told that it's a Shia theology that's actually a little closer to Sunni, but they're friends. It's not a dependent relationship. You know, Iran is not the the drug dealer, and Yemen's the drug user. Iran is not the pimp, and Yemen the prostitute. It's a friend relationship. And so in that regard, you know, how would you react if one of your friends came to you and started ordering you about and telling you what to do? You wouldn't stay friends much longer. You'd say, hey, you know, I don't need this. I'm going to go my own way. But I don't see Iran doing that, because I think the Iranians are smart enough to recognize that what Trump is about here, I think, is there's an economic element to it. And I had to, you know, I was just thinking off the top of my head when, you know, you and I talked with Scott on Monday or Tuesday. And but I've had, you know, I had time to reflect on it more this week. I think what the United States, what Trump is trying to do is destroy BRICS and make sure that he can put a sort of a nail in their coffin. And Iran is the linchpin, the key target that they've got to take out. They take out Iran, then that's going to disrupt BRICS, because the current plans that are underway for to construct that north-south transport corridor, Russia sees that as, you know, once that is fully established and up and running, Russia no longer has to worry about Turkey shutting down the Dardanelles and going through from the Black Sea to the Mediterranean. Right now, as Russia is part of its strategic military planning and having to anticipate future threats, they've got to be concerned about what happens if Turkey decides to blockade that port. That cuts off an important access point for Russia. And so they have to devote military resources to that and planning, etc. Once that becomes no longer relevant, because going in and out of the Black Sea won't be an economic priority for Russia, but it's going through Iran, it changes the strategic picture. So I think a lot of this U.S. effort is directed towards, they do want to destroy Iran. They want to change the leadership. They're not interested in negotiating a deal with the mullahs or with the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. They want to eliminate him so that they can put a government in place in Iran that is controlled by the West. That will be another way to try to encircle Russia. I think that's what's going on. So the Yemen stuff is a bit of a sideshow. And you know, they pretend it's for freedom of navigation, but no, it's to counter the Houthis' attempt to punish Israel and force Israel to stop its war of genocide.
Here is what the Russian foreign ministry said. The threats of airstrikes against Iran's nuclear and energy infrastructure are unacceptable. Mm-hmm. And do you think that you've mentioned the main goal is BRICS, and we know that right now, we know that the main goal of the war in Ukraine was BRICS. Do you think that the first project is failing? That's why they're going after Iran?
Well, I don't.
How
I don't.
Would be the reaction on the part of Russia and China?
So let me ask you: why do you say the war in Ukraine was about BRICS?
Because they want to break down Russia and then go after China.
Yeah, I disagree. Politely, of course. You're wrong. let's call each other names. No, I think the threat, let's call it the threat BRICS poses, is something that has emerged out of the special military operation. I think prior to the special military operation, it was provoked by the West and U.S. buildup, helping Ukraine build up its force going into January of 2022, February 2022. It really had forced Putin's hand. You know, we're not going to let you build up. And they attacked. But in the aftermath of that, when all the sanctions start coming in on Russia, and at the same time, there are sanctions being levied upon China, that China and Russia then start, you know, saying, hey, these guys are crazy. You know, let's get together and defend ourselves. And then BRICS really began taking on a new life. And, you know, I saw that firsthand in St. Petersburg a year ago in June. With, you know, 38 countries were there, and they recognize we can no longer be dependent upon the United States and its financial system. If we continue to depend upon using the dollar as the currency for trade, they can hold us hostage. They can steal our money. They can punish us if we don't have an alternative. So that's where this desire to go, you know, to start building up BRICS. And frankly, I don't think anybody in the United States government took BRICS as a serious issue in 2022. But I would alter your thesis by saying it wasn't BRICS that helped instigate this, the start of this war, but this war certainly has elevated BRICS as a threat to the international financial system controlled by the United States, that now, you know, Trump is taking it seriously. You know, he'd mentioned before he's going to punish countries that try to stop using the dollar, you know, that kind of thing. Trump may have set the world on fire now with this whole tariff business and China punching back overnight. And so the BRICS is becoming a real alternative. And I don't think the United States has properly assessed that how serious these countries are on looking for an alternative path, which, you know, brings us back to Iran. That north-south corridor that's going to go from the Arabian Sea and the mouth of the Straits of Hormuz, goes up through Iran to the Caspian Sea, that they can move it by ship, container ship, across the Caspian, up to a terminus in Russia, going all the way to St. Petersburg if they want. And then they can go out, you know, so now Russia's got another alternative. And an important alternative. When that finally kicks in, it no longer has to worry about how are we going to get through the Suez Canal, and then how do we get through the Bosphorus, the Dardanelles. So I think the connection, though, with the war in Ukraine and in Iran is both are designed to try to weaken Russia, to attack Russia. Going after Iran is not just going after Iran. It is going after Russia. And I hope the Russians understand that. And I think they do by that statement they made. Excuse me. Got a lot of pollen in the air down here that's affecting things. We had the issue came up during our Scott and I chatting with you on Tuesday. Will Russia do anything if Iran is attacked? And I believe Scott's position was, oh, no, absolutely not. And after going over, I reviewed again the security cooperation agreement that Russia and Iran signed. And after reading that, I'm more convinced than ever Russia absolutely will get engaged militarily, because if the attack goes unanswered, you know, basically put yourself in Iran's position. We signed this agreement with Russia. Now we get attacked by the United States. It's killed, you know, a million of our people, maybe. And Russia doesn't do anything. What the hell good are they? So, and when you read through that agreement, you realize Russia not only will be in a position to both intervene and retaliate on behalf of Iran, but in advance, it's providing complete intelligence sharing, cooperation on military equipment, and providing personnel to operate that equipment, and then also moving on the diplomatic front. So it's a comprehensive relationship. This is really important to them for their economic survival going forward. They got to have another access to the oceans. You know, they can't rely on just coming out of the Baltic Sea. So this is, I think those words from Russia, you got to take them seriously.
Here is what Bloomberg reported. The title is "To Bomb or Not to Bomb Iran is Now the Question" on the part of the United States and the Trump administration in this article. And how do you feel right now on Tuesday? As you mentioned, you and Scott, both of you were believing that maybe the United States is going to attack Iran.
Yeah.
Find it right now?
Yeah. I don't see any change yet. I don't discount the possibility that through diplomatic efforts, Russia can turn it off. But Trump's, there are some areas where Trump, says stuff and doesn't follow through. But there are other areas where, like the tariffs, I'm going to impose tariffs, and he did it. So, with respect to bombing Iran, I think he's going to do it. And, it'll be great news for the Trump haters, because that's going to end up destroying his presidency. And they'll no longer have to worry about Donald Trump. But in terms of the world situation, this is the kind of scenario that, along the lines of how World War I got started. There was no imminent threat. There was no country was at risk of losing, of being eliminated. But the war started because of, people took offense. The Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated by a Serbian, and then the Austro-Hungarians went after the Serbs, and the Serbs were backed by Russia because of the Eastern Orthodox Christian faith. And, next thing you know, you got one of the bloodiest wars of the century. The second bloodiest war, I guess you could say. And for what? And so now here's Trump claiming that Iran it's working on a nuclear bomb. No, it's not. Iran taking, they have been the victim. And people have said, what? No, they're a well, not just seven. Let's go back to the bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993, the attacks on the U.S. embassies in Tanzania and Kenya in 1998, the attack on the USS Cole, all of these were Al-Qaeda operations. And, you know, everybody's going to start going, oh, yeah, the CIA directed 9/11. Just, you know, stop. Just, okay, if you believe that, fine. But the actual perpetrators, the ones that were, you know, flying the planes and crashing into buildings, those were members of Al-Qaeda's group. Al-Qaeda is a Sunni extremist group. While they had some contacts with Iran, ultimately the creation of ISIS, some, and you know, there's credible evidence that the United States helped that along, whether intentionally or not. But ISIS was this radical Salafist Sunni movement. Iran's Shia. And people say, oh, the, you know, that's not really a difference. Well, sorry. It's about as profound a difference as between Roman Catholics celebrating the Latin Mass and Pentecostals who, you know, are speaking in tongues and handling snakes. Both claim to be Christian, just as you know, both the Sunni and Shia Muslims, and the various, there are at least, you know, three other Shia sects within Shiism. They all profess and follow Allah, but they don't necessarily agree, and many times have killed each other. And so here we portray Iran as this menacing terrorist threat, when you look at the groups that have actually been carrying out attacks that have been listed in the State Department annual report, the groups are all Sunni. The groups are the ones funded by people like the Saudis and the Qataris and, you know, the Gulf Arabs. It's not Iran, but in our mythology, we have to make Iran the number one terrorist state. So that's why I say Iran has been a victim. And then on top of that, we've got clear evidence that the U.S. has been funding terrorist groups that are carrying out attacks inside Iran. So when Iran takes steps to try to protect itself, then we accuse them of being threatening or aggressive. So, you know, that it's a long answer to come around and say that right now they're not building a nuke. And in fact, that agreement that they signed with Russia on the 17th of January makes it clear that they're going to cooperate with Russia on non-proliferation. If Iran started working on a bomb, that would violate that agreement. I don't see Iran violating the agreement with Russia, because the nature of that agreement basically gives them some protection. They've got Russia's got their back now. And they're much more confident that they could face whatever threat the U.S. poses with the help of Russia and with China through BRICS.
Larry, how about the news coming out of the Trump administration talking about they're considering indirect talks with Iran?
Well, I thought they rejected that. You know, initially when I heard Iran, because initially Iran said, we're not having direct talks with you. Well, let's have a mediator, someone to mediate. And I think the ones they're looking to would be either Russia or the Saudis. But then the last I saw, the Trump administration said, you know, hell no, we're not going to do that. So
here is what Donald Trump said, Larry, in terms of the talks.
I think it's better if we have direct talks. I think it goes faster and you understand the other side a lot better than if you go through intermediaries. They wanted to use intermediaries. I don't think that's necessarily true anymore. I think they're concerned. I think they feel vulnerable, and I don't want them to feel that way. And I think they want to meet Iran. They're talking about Iran.
You said you don't think they want to use intermediaries anymore. Did they send another letter?
Yeah.
Did the UAE let you know about this?
I know for a fact. I think they'd like to have direct talks.
Can you say anything about what the letter said from Iran?
No, I just think they, I'm just telling you, I think they want to have, forget about letters, I think they want to have direct talks.
When did that happen? On Pete Hicks said.
Yeah, so that, you know, that gives me a little more hope that at least he's talking about having direct talks. The problem was with the initial letter from Trump to them was basically, hey, take off all your clothes and run around naked. And Iran is like, we're not going to do that. You know, it was like, get rid of your nuclear program. You can't have a nuclear program. No, peaceful or no, you can't have that. Can't have any relationship with the Houthis or the Hezbollah or Hamas. Nope. You got to you got to be our bitch and do what we say. And Iran goes, no. That's you're not showing us any respect. And they'll be. They'll be playing some Aretha Franklin, R-E-S-P-E-C-T, respect. Iran wants some respect.
By the way, the talks between the United States and Iran is not the full picture of the Middle East, Larry. The full picture is something tremendously different from the way that the Trump administration is trying to picture for us. Here is what Jeffrey Sachs said in terms of the conflict in the Middle East, both with Israel and Iran.
By the way, the U.S. completely handed over foreign policy to Netanyahu 30 years ago. The Israel lobby dominates American politics. Just have no doubt about it. I could explain for hours how it works. It's very dangerous. I'm hoping that Trump will not destroy his administration and worse the Palestinian people because of Netanyahu, who I regard as a war criminal, properly indicted by the ICC, and that needs to be told no more, that there will be a state of Palestine on the borders of the 4th of June, 1967, according to international law, as the only way for peace. It's the only way for Europe to have peace on your borders with the Middle East, is the two-state solution. There is only one obstacle to it, by the way, and that is the veto of the United States in the UN Security Council. So if you want to have some influence, tell the United States, drop the veto. You are together with 180 countries in the world. The only ones that oppose a Palestinian state are the United States, Israel. So this is a place where Europe could have a big influence. Europe has gone silent about the JCPOA and Iran. Netanyahu's greatest dream in life is a war between the United States and Iran. He's not given up, and it's not impossible that that would come also. And that's because the U.S. in this regard does not have an independent foreign policy. It is run by Israel.
This is the bigger picture of the Middle East, Larry.
Yeah.
Nobody seems to care about. I don't know if Donald Trump he's still willing to listen to Jeffrey Sachs and his idea on the Middle East.
Probably not. And I think Jeff is right that the U.S. government is a complete captive hostage of this Israeli lobby. You know, it's gotten to the point where constitutional rights are being trampled on just because if you say anything critical of Israel, you're accused of being an anti-Semite, that you hate Jews, which is just so ridiculous because Jeffrey Sachs Jewish. So what, he hates Jews because he's a Jew? I mean, it's just it's ludicrous. So unfortunately, I see, Israel is also on its own path to destruction. Yeah, it's murdering Palestinians again, 100 or more every day now. Children. The images of these dead babies, beheaded children, legitimately, you can see the corpses without the heads. And again, the only country in the world that's trying to stop it, that's actually taking military action to try to send a message is Yemen through the Houthis. The only ones. You know, there's real irony here. Because when the Nazis made it clear that they were going to, you know, exterminate Jews and proceeded to do so, the world was largely silent. And the complaint of the Jews who founded Israel was the world stood silent and didn't speak up. And now that's being played out, only they're in the role of the Nazis. And they're doing the extermination of Palestinians, both Muslims and Christians. And the world is largely silent. The United Nations, mute. The U.S. through its veto of the Security Council prevents any kind of action. But, you know, what Israel is doing in the name of fighting terrorism. And I think as we discussed in a previous show, the total deaths caused or blamed on Palestinians and in terrorist attacks from August of 2000 through October 7th of 2023 was a grand total of 2,755. That's over 25 years. And Israel now is killing that many in 2 weeks in Palestine, in Gaza. And, you know, the numbers are, you know, the official numbers are somewhere around 60,000. But others insist that they haven't even recovered and been able to account for the bodies that are buried under rubble. So the disproportionality, you know, it's one thing to use violence to defend yourself. You know, if your life is at risk, someone is threatening to kill you, and they've actually got the means, you know, they're holding a firearm or a knife or a club in their hand, and they're approaching you, then under, you know, most laws, at least here in the United States, if your back is to the wall, you can shoot and kill that person. It's a killing like that is a last resort. But you don't get to kill that person and then every bystander back behind him that may be a friend of his. You don't get to do that. Then you get charged with murder. That's exactly what Israel's doing. These are murderers. And by definition, they like to call the civilians collateral damage. But they're not killing fighters. They're not killing Hamas military personnel. They're largely killing civilians, making the place uninhabitable because they want to drive the Palestinians out so they can take possession of the land.
Larry, Donald Trump was talking about direct talks with Iran in this video that I played for you. We know that Iranians are, the argument on the part of Iranians is that they're putting a lot of pressure on Iran. That's why we're not going to negotiate with the Trump administration. Why they're not considering to just lifting some sanctions, just easing the pressure and changing the attitude if they're interested in direct talks? Because this is the way I asked this question to Scott Rader, if you remember, on Tuesday, which he didn't answer it, and he went and answered some other questions. How do you find why the Trump administration is not interested in that?
I think they view it as a sign of weakness. And, you know, Trump's all about projecting strength, being the, you know, the alpha dog in the fight. So, you know, any kind of concessions would be, I think Trump would consider it a showing weakness, and he doesn't want to show weakness in negotiations.
You know that Zelensky during the conflict in Ukraine was pictured in Russia as if they defeat us, they're going to be the next target would be Europe.
Yeah.
Here is Netanyahu doing the same. Here is what he said about Iran.
The Iranian axis, the Iranian terror axis, which threatens not only us, but Europe and many of our neighbors in the Middle East. We're committed to doing so. And by doing that, we're also protecting Europe.
It's just a goddamn lie. You know, Hamas, Hezbollah, we've got the record of their quote terrorist attacks. They haven't carried out a single attack in Europe, and you know I've looked at going back 25 years. The groups that have carried out the terrorist attacks in Europe, in Paris and London, were ISIS. Oh, who's funding ISIS? Well, the United States helped fund ISIS, and the Saudis helped fund ISIS. They're Sunnis. And who was fighting ISIS in Syria? Well, that'd be Iran. So, again, this the lies about terrorism from Netanyahu are just, you know, it's a bald-faced lies. Absolutely not true.
By the way, they're supporting the government in Syria right now, which are the main, these are literally the Daesh or ISIS.
You mean Israel?
Israel somehow.
Israel is supporting a bunch of terrorists who were chopping off the heads most recently of Alawites and Christians. I regret the time that I was once thought I could support Israel. They're shameful, and it is appalling what the Jewish nationalists who live there support and advocate. It's a true expression of evil, and you know, as history will record this moment and look back and say, why didn't someone do something? Why was this allowed? And it was allowed in part because the United States completely enabled it. If Trump is foolish enough to follow through on his threat to attack Iran, that could literally ultimately lead to the destruction of Israel. And because Iran's going to hit back and hit back hard. And when the Israeli people start suffering casualties in a way that they've never suffered, then I think you're going to see that there will be great anger directed at Netanyahu for getting them into this mess. But there's always a possibility that they could react by saying, oh, no, we're attacked by an outside enemy and they'll pull together. But the tensions within Israel are so great right now. I think it would go the other way, further fracturing the country, just as it is here in the United States, candidly.
Larry, do you think Donald Trump is doing something in Ukraine, or he's just playing around with the situation? Because so far we haven't seen any sort of positive outcome.
Yeah.
And they're just, Ukrainians are just attacking Russia, and there is a meeting between among Zelensky, Ukraine, France, and the United Kingdom. They're talking about peacekeepers in Ukraine again. I don't know what is that all about. And how do you see right now the case of Ukraine?
Well, let's first talk about U.S. What is the United States doing to support it? Sending mixed signals. I think military equipment that's in the pipeline, there's still allowing that to go forward. Problem is, there's not a lot of it. Then at the same time, the NATO meeting to support Ukraine, Pete Hegseth said, we're not attending. So, you know, he wasn't going to go. sending a message that the United States is not supportive of Ukraine in that regard. Militarily, Russia's getting stronger, not weaker, and Ukraine's getting weaker, not stronger. And we had an interesting testimony, yesterday, by General Chris Cavoli, the head of the U.S. European Command. On the one hand, in his testimony, he said, Russia's military capability has been degraded by this war. But yet, you look at everything. Then in the rest of his testimony, he goes, Russia suffered a lot of losses, 790,000 casualties, but their army's grown. What? Yeah, their army's gotten bigger. Yeah, 1.5 million. And he said they're recruiting 30,000 a month. So that's another 360,000 a year coming in. Oh, well, what about their equipment? And he said, we destroyed thousands of tanks and vehicles, but they've replaced it all. Their industrial base is such they can replace it all, which they have. And he says, they're building 1,500 tanks a year, where in the United States, we're sort of building 135. And why do I say sort of? Because those aren't new. There's not a factory where a new tank is actually built from scratch. They're taking existing frames, refurbishing them, updating the software, updating the armor, and they're calling that, we're building new tanks. Only 135. And Bradley fighting vehicles, we don't produce those anymore. Nope, we're out of those. And artillery shells. And Cavoli admitted this. Russia's producing more artillery shells in 1 year than Europe and the United States combined. In fact, three times the amount. Aviation and Navy haven't been touched. They've not suffered any significant damage and degradation of capabilities. So it's interesting. You say they've degraded, but you're saying that their military on the ground has dramatically improved its operations, that soldiers are carrying out increasingly sophisticated maneuvers, that they've got all of the equipment that they need, that they've got air power. What are you talking about? So, he is somewhat divorced from reality. And this is where, Trump is sending mixed signals. It is Cavoli, according to that article that was appeared on Monday in the New York Times by Adam Entaus, was one personally was involved in getting HIMARS and attack of missiles into the theater and helping identify targets inside Russia to attack. He has been an aggressor in this and a leading proponent. So, from Russia's standpoint, he's a war criminal. And would want to deal with him accordingly. The United States, I don't think, would ever let that happen. But Ukraine's situation militarily is going to get worse. It's not going to get better. Despite this massive propaganda campaign that's running right now in the United States to proclaim, Russia's on the ropes. It's suffering militarily. It's suffering politically. It can't continue like this. It's a lie, but that's the messaging that's going forward. So if Britain, France move forward with the deployment of so-called peacekeeping forces, they're going to be killed. And at that point, Britain and France will have a decision to make. Are they going to try to go to war with Russia? Because if they do, they'll be wiped out.
Here is what Marco Rubio said about he said that the United States would learn within weeks, not months, if Russia is serious about ending the war. It seems to me that the same sort of rhetoric that the ball is on Russia's court and What do they want from Russia? Because how can we say that they're not serious about the talks?
They want Russia to surrender. That's what they want. They want Russia to agree to a ceasefire, a permanent ceasefire. You'll stop firing, and then they'll be rebuilding Ukrainian military capability. Boy, we gotta pause now. We can actually take time to recruit and train and restock weapons. And Russia's been through this before, and Russia's going, no. We're not going down that road. Are you familiar with the cartoon Charlie Brown? And Lucy, you know, one of the current themes is Lucy say, "Oh, come on, Charlie, I got the football. Come kick the football." Charlie, "Oh, okay." Runs up to kick it. She pulls the ball away, falls on his butt, and keeps doing it over and over. You know, and at some point, you got Charlie Brown's got to say, "You know what? I don't trust you, and you keep pulling the football away. So we're gonna do something different. You know, we're gonna put the football on a tee, and you get away, and I'll kick it." That's what Russia's saying. You know, Russia is no longer going to be Charlie Brown, but the United States is Lucy holding the football. They've had enough of that, so they're not going to agree to the ceasefire. Rubio keeps talking about, "Oh, well, Russia's going to have to make concessions." No, they don't. Not at all. If they were losing, if their economy was collapsing, yeah, then maybe they'd be desperate to find a negotiated way out of this. But they're not. And that's what Rubio and Waltz and Hegseth and apparently Trump failed to understand. Trump doesn't hold any strong cards. And yet I could point to you a couple of articles in this last week. One was by the speechwriter of George W. Bush, Mark Thiessen, insisting, "Oh, yeah, Trump's got all sorts of leverage over the Russians. Oh, they're suffering." You know, he even said something just show you how stupid these people are. He said, "Oh, yeah, Russia's army is so weak because it's moved so slowly through the Donbass, which is just wide open farmland." God, you know, you got to work hard to be that stupid. And what has happened in the Donbass over the last 9 years, it's the industrial heart of Russia. You know, I've got a rubber band on my arm that says Donbass, Serce Rossiya, Donbass, the heart of Russia. And over the last 9 years, prior to 2022, the Ukrainians were building extensive fortifications, and one city, village after another, line after line after line. So it wasn't easy to just march through them or even go around them. And so, yeah, that's one reason the Russians have moved slowly. Same thing happened in World War II, except the Nazis only. They only had it about a year and a half, 2 years tops, to try to build fortifications in that area. So that they didn't have 9 years like the Ukrainians did. But you got people like Thiessen out there arguing that, "Oh yeah, Trump's got all the leverage, and Ukraine, these Russians better, you know, toe the line and come, you know, bow to Trump's demands." Not gonna happen. And you know, the foot dragging they get accused of, it's not, you know, Russia's not dragging its feet. Russia keeps saying, "Here's what we not want, demand. These are our conditions. We're not backing off of these conditions. The Ukrainians stop fighting now, and they withdraw their forces from Donetsk, Luhansk, Kherson, and Zaporizhia." That's for starters. You're gonna elect a legitimate authority in Kiev, and the U.S. and the West has got to stop supplying Ukraine with intelligence and targeting data. So those are just three of the things Russia has insisted upon as prerequisites before you can actually engage in any kind of negotiation to bring an end to the war. U.S. ain't listening. They keep thinking, oh, yeah, I hear them say that, but they don't really mean it. No, they do mean it. You know, you can tell yourself they don't mean it, but they mean it.
I would argue that they really want to put an end to the conflict in Ukraine, but you don't see that much. They're not that much informed about the complexity of the issue in Ukraine.
Yes.
That's missing. And Russia is suffering from that because they have to explain everything for the Trump administration. What's going on? What are we going to deal with you? And it doesn't seem that is going well right now.
No, well, actually, Dmitriev met in Washington yesterday with Steve Witkoff. And he had very positive comments afterwards about at least they may be moving forward on the diplomatic front to restore normal relations between Russia and the United States. I think the Russians need to take into account, I don't think they appreciate how much opposition there is to Trump's resident. It's below the surface. You know, he's had a good run for the last 2 months. Now that the stock market has, had a dramatic decline the last 2 days because of the sanctions or the tariffs. And I think Trump's political standing could erode dramatically if the economy crashes, which it very well could. Because the economic theory behind his tariffs is just, it's divorced from reality. They didn't look at the actual tariffs that countries have imposed on the United States. What they did is they looked at the trade imbalance in those countries which are running a surplus with the United States and we're running a trade deficit, and then they divided it by a factor, and then that's how they determined what the quote tariff was. Well, it's not the tariff; it's a trade deficit, but it's in part because of what the United States is buying, what it's spending money on. You know, we're buying certain goods from Vietnam, a lot of clothing, a lot of shoes, and yes, those used to be jobs in the United States. So, again, Trump is on very dangerous ground right now, because if this economy crashes and burns, then his claim of making America great again and making America rich again gets flushed down the toilet. And then these different groups that are still heavily invested by the neocons will come out of the woodwork against him, and they'll impose sanctions on Russia through the Congress. I mean, it's a pretty shaky situation. And if I'm the Russians, I wouldn't bet on this being a long-term relationship at all. I wish it were, but I think unless Trump does some serious changes in his policies, both with respect to the Middle East, Iran, Ukraine, and the tariffs, he's going to be in trouble.
I don't know if you saw the article in Politico. It says that Trump tariffs threaten U.S. weapons production. It seems that these tariffs are just making the things difficult for the military industrial complex to produce arms there. How do you think that would be a very important issue for the Trump administration?
Well, it's already, even before the tariffs went in, remember, China had cut off antimony, gallium, a couple of other rare earth minerals, all of which are critical rare earth minerals for producing, in the case of antimony, explosives for artillery shells, essential components for military equipment. So yeah, that was already cut off, and they're going to start feeling the pain. So
that's just to wrap it up. Here is what the Secretary General of NATO said.
Of the position of the U.S. administration, but let me start from a different angle. When President Trump came in, the war was not developing in the right direction. We saw the front line moving from the east to the west, and we want the front line to move from the west to the east. It wasn't. The Russians were very slowly, and against a lot of people dying or getting seriously wounded on their side, and by the way, also the Ukrainian side, but they were making very slow progress. And we know that many, many people have died or are seriously injured because of this war. We know that some cities have been destroyed. The whole infrastructures have been destroyed. So for President Trump coming in to say, I want to do the utmost to bring this war to a just and lasting end, I think is commendable. And that's what I'm.
It seems to me that he's trying to point out the position of Europeans, not the position of the Trump administration. Do you understand what he's talking about in terms of the position of Europeans?
Yeah, I think the description is he's trying to put lipstick on a dying pig, you know, make it look pretty, but because it ain't pretty with the way it's going. You know, Europe is, prior to the imposition of the tariffs yesterday, Europe was already in some economic chaos. Now it's going to get worse. And they hate Trump. They hate Trump. Trump doesn't like them either. And so, but so far everyone's pretending, oh yeah, we're all best buddies. That's not going to last. You know, Europe's going to try to find its own way, but they don't have it. They have no military strength to speak of. You know, they're a dress-up crowd. They're pretend. And now, if they actually try to follow through on their threats, it's going to end badly for them. And you know, Russia sees them as a threat. And how could they not? Russia is not the one sending 5,000 troops to the border of France or Germany. It's Germany that just sent 5,000 troops to the border of Estonia. The last time there were Germans in Estonia coming across the border was called World War II. And, you know, the Russians naturally, they're taking this extremely seriously. It's the West. It's just being cavalier.
Russia's position on Europe. Do you think Russia is finding Europe as time goes by, and Trump's position and Europe's position, are they trying to improve their position in terms of having some sort of relationship with Russia in the aftermath of a Ukrainian settlement, or they're just going the opposite way?
Well, I'm not sure what Trump's, you know, real objective is. I believe that the Russian objective is simple. Let's try to restore normal diplomatic relations, but recognize that the West cannot be trusted. We're not going to be dependent upon them. We are not going to hook ourselves to them in any way. So that's, you know, Russia's hopeful that they can get back on a normal relations with the United States, but they're not betting on it. They'd like to see it, but they haven't, you know, put everything at risk in order to achieve that. Europe is irrelevant. It has no natural resources to speak of, and it's not an industrial power. It's it's a collection of blood-sucking bureaucrats.
Thank you so much, Larry, for being with us today.
Yeah, sorry for the technical difficulties there, but I'm not in control.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. We'll talk. See you on Monday.
See you on Monday. Yeah.
Okay.
Take care, Larry. Bye-bye.